Good morning. Welcome. And this is Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm your host, Taylor Velasquez. And March is Women's History Month. And since the ratification of the 19th Amendment in 1920, women have continued to fight for voting rights, representation, economic freedoms, and against discrimination on the basis of gender. And especially a year in lockdown due to the COVID-19 pandemic, these issues are all especially relevant today. We have seen women lose their jobs at higher rates compared to men, the murder of Breonna Taylor sparking the Say Her Name campaign. It's all hasn't been bad, though. At the same time, we have gained the first woman vice president. And this morning, we'll be speaking to historians and activists on continuing the need for feminism and how women have remained resilient in their fights for equality. And we want to hear from you. How are you celebrating Women's History Month? Do you have stories you would like to share about the women in your life? And how can we use this month to move forward to an equitable future? Email letstalk@kunm.org or call in live at 277-5866. And my first guest is Kathleen Cahill, a professor of history with Penn State and author of Recasting the Vote, How Women of Color Transformed the Suffrage Movement, which came out last year. Good morning, Kathleen. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. I'm happy to be here.
And can you tell us about some of the women you write about and how they were influential in the fight for suffrage?
Absolutely. And one of the things I need to mention is that I used to teach at UNM, and it's partly because I was living there and teaching at UNM that I came to this project. So the book looks at six women of color, and that includes Nina Otero Warren from New Mexico, three Native women, a woman named Gertrude Bonins at Kalisaw, who was Yankton Dakota from what's now South Dakota, Marie Louise Botno Baldwin from the Turtle Mountain Chippewa Nation, and Laura Cornelius Kellogg, who is Wisconsin Oneida. And I mentioned those women first because I talk quite a bit about New Mexico and how women from different racial and ethnic groups and the tribes had very different experiences when it came to suffrage. And then the other women I write about are Kerry Williams Clifford, who is an African-American poet and activist, and Mabel Pinkua Lee, who was a Chinese suffragist.
And how have your experience living in New Mexico and teaching here in New Mexico influenced your studies?
So part of it was that the stories about women's suffrage are often primarily about white women from back east, right? New York, Pennsylvania, Washington, D.C. Recently, particularly scholars of African-American history have done a great job of showing how black women were involved in the movement. But being in the West and understanding that it's a really multicultural place made me realize that a lot of stories were missing from our discussions of suffrage.
Right. And you mentioned that these stories are actually East Coast-centric, they're white-centric, so we don't really hear them in the mainstream. How can we make sure we don't lose these women's narratives?
That's a great question. I think that during the anniversary year, a lot of folks working on state centennial suffrage commissions were really aware of and attuned to trying to bring in a wide diversity of stories, racial diversity, class diversity, religious diversity. And so particularly in Western states, I think we saw some recognition for Asian American, Native American, and Latinas. But there's still work to be done. And so I think, as you say, a lot of it's being aware. Mm-hmm. These stories are out there and we need to include them.
Mm-hmm. And how do you think teaching a more inclusive women's history impacts the greater move for women's equality?
I think, you know, as a historian, I see that women were involved in these movements and helped shape them, from the beginning. And if we don't understand that history, sometimes there's a sense of, you know, in our current movements, where are these women coming from? Or some of these questions seem to mainstream, maybe white Americans, come out of nowhere. But in fact, there are deep histories about questions of racism and white supremacy, of violence against women of color, right? Things that we might think are new in the news now. As you mentioned, Breonna Taylor, right? The recent shootings in Atlanta of the Asian women, these have deep, deep roots. And understanding the history helps us think about how to address those contemporary problems.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of understanding the history, would you be able to explain more about how the Native American women fought for suffrage and what that looked like?
Sure. I think, right, as we celebrate Representative Deb Haaland becoming the first Native Secretary of Interior, and as she, of course, was the first of two Native women in Congress in 2018, it's a really historic moment. And in New Mexico, women, Native women were not enfranchised in 1920, and it's a little complicated. And a historian, a PhD from UNM named Maurice Crandall, has written about how Pueblo people had a really conflicted relationship with the vote. American leaders told them that if they participated in elections, they would be giving up their tribal rights, and especially rights to tribally held land. And so they were often hesitant to do that. And so, you know, we have to remember that not all Native people are the same, but there were Native women who were fighting for suffrage. And because Native people were not considered citizens, most people in 1920, but wards of the government, they had to keep fighting after 1920 for suffrage rights and citizenship rights. And they weren't just fighting for Native women, but they were fighting for Native men as well. So, in 1924, Congress passes the Indian Citizenship Act, which, again, not every Native person supported because many people said, we have our own nation. But people that I write about, like Gertrude Bonin, really saw this as an opportunity to engage politically, to use the vote in states like New Mexico, where there were a significant population, and she thought that this was a way to kind of gain power and to have a say in federal Indian policy. You know, this is a time where on the reservations there's a lot of poverty and health disparities. Children are being taken to boarding schools. So she saw the right to vote as something that they could use to address these problems. But states in the West, like New Mexico, often tried to disenfranchise people almost immediately. And the New Mexico State Supreme Court says that Native people living on reservations can't vote, so even though they have citizenship.
Mm-hmm.
And that disenfranchisement lasts up through the Voting Rights Act, right, of the post, you know, kind of 60s and 70s.
Right, and we want to hear from you. Are you a woman? Do you know women who've lost their jobs during this pandemic? Do you think gender played a role? Tell us what happened and let us know at 277-5866 or email letstalk@KUNM or tweet using the hashtag at letstalknm. So, Kathleen, you going off this idea that not all women got the right to vote after the ratification of the 19th Amendment, do you think the original suffrage movement focusing on white women left women of color behind?
So, The white women did, yes, but I would say absolutely that particularly African American women were part of the original suffrage movement, right? The conversations, especially coming out of the abolitionist movement, it was a biracial movement, and it's really not until after the Civil War and the 15th Amendment, which enfranchises black men, that the white suffrage movement really turns away from that biracial coalition. Black women continue to fight for suffrage, and again, other women, are fighting as well. And so it's really a deliberate choice. White women, particularly after Reconstruction, want to have the support of white Southern men, and so they are very willing to kind of separate themselves from particularly black suffragists. Mm-hmm. Other women of color, like Nina Otero Warren, there's more willingness on the part of white suffragists to work with Spanish-speaking women in New Mexico because they have political power, right? Particularly Spanish-speaking men in the New Mexico state legislature. So in New Mexico, Spanish is a bilingual suffrage is a bilingual movement, and a much more inclusive in terms of the Spanish-speaking women than it is perhaps elsewhere in the U.S.
Right. And now that we have all lived through a year of the pandemic due to COVID, and COVID was able to shine a lot of lights on the inequities that are present in our society. And the Bureau of Labor Statistics released a final jobs report in 2020 that showed in December the workforce lost over 140,000 jobs, but women lost a net of 156,000 jobs, while men gained 16,000 jobs, meaning that women lost 100% of the jobs in December. How does something like this happen in our society?
That's a really good question. You know, women's jobs have always sort of been the first to go. If you look at, say, the Great Depression, there was a real focus on getting men back to work in terms of the federal New Deal policies. And there was a sense that, you know, men should be the heads of household and therefore have the paying jobs. So it's often women's work that's seen as less essential. But more importantly, I think for this moment, women are really continuing to bear the burden of the child care and household work, right? That's work. It's often not acknowledged as work. But now that teachers aren't able to be in the classroom and daycares are closed, right? Working women are doing both their work from home on Zoom, but also trying to help their kids with schoolwork or, you know, do all of the dishes for every meal. It's that double burden that we don't always see, but is still clearly there and affecting women.
Mm-hmm. And going off that idea, some people may question why we still need feminism, and what do you say to those people?
Well, yes, I would agree with that. One of the women I write about, Mabel Pinkwali, says feminism is merely an equality between men and women in all spheres. And, you know, we haven't reached that equality. We see that in the disparities in pay between men and women. Again, I think COVID has really laid bare that women still do the majority of work in the home. And, you know, we don't have equal representation in politics. There are lots of places where there's still disparities based on gender and sex.
And what do you think will help solve all these inequities coming out of COVID? What do you think the next step should be?
Oh, that's really a good question. And I'm not an expert, but I would say that history shows us that we can use the government to be useful, right? We can subsidize childcare. We can offer, you know, a variety of programs that help with some of the burdens that families have. I totally appreciate, and I know this is an issue in New Mexico, the caution of reopening schools, because obviously health care is, you know, extremely important. We don't want people getting sick. And again, women, the burden of being caregivers for the elderly or the ill often falls on women. So it's a balance, but I think that we can harness the power of state and federal governments to help address these issues. I think that's extremely important, and that's been done in the past to good effect.
And what does Women's History Month mean to you?
Well, you know, I enjoy being able to share my work during Women's History Month, but it would be even better if we didn't have the need for it. And that's another place, right, where there are still inequities. Women's history and history books, you know, maybe there'll be one or two women mentioned, or, you know, it's often the case of the woman's history is kind of in the little box in the corner away from the main text, not in the main text. And until we've really kind of rewritten our histories to incorporate women and women of color more seamlessly, that then we can have, you know, there'll be no need for a special month to highlight it.
Great. I'm going to have to pause you there. We need to go to a quick break. This is Let's Talk New Mexico on 89.9 KUNM. I'm Taylor Velazquez, and we'll be back in a moment.
It's spring cleaning time, the perfect time to clear that old car out of your garage or that old truck out of your driveway. Maybe you've been meaning to get rid of it but haven't gotten around to it. KUNM makes it easy to donate. One phone call and voila, everything's taken care of. We come and tow it away. You get a tax deduction, a KUNM membership, and it helps us pay for the programs you love. So don't put it off anymore. Call 888-KUNM-CAR. That's 888-586-6227.
The Kalidor String Quartet joined us a few years ago as PT Young Artists. Coming up, how they're staying positive and how they've kept on keeping on during the pandemic, and their gorgeous performance of music by Beethoven. The Kalidor Quartet on the next Performance Today from APM.
Weekday mornings at 9 on KUNM.
Welcome back to Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm Taylor Velazquez, and we're taking your calls about Women's History Month. How are you empowering women during this month? Give us a call at 277-5866 and let us know. And now I would like to introduce our next guest, Dr. Sylvia Ramos-Cruz, retired general surgeon and women's rights activist. Good morning, Sylvia. How are you doing?
I'm very well, Taylor. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for being on. And you said you entered the general surgeon field. How and when did you enter that career?
I'm not hearing you very well, but I think you were asking about when I entered general surgery, when I became a surgeon. So that was way back in 1974, I began my training when I graduated from medical school. And at that time, 0.5% of surgeons in the United States were women. Today, I think the percent is maybe 25%. We're still a long way off from parity in terms of the fact that women represent 51% of the people in this country.
Right. And how long was your career?
It was 41 years. I retired at the end of 2015, and I enjoyed every minute of my work. Still think about some of the women I treated, especially towards the end of my career when I focused on breast diseases and breast cancer. And I left. I retired not because I was tired of what I was doing, but because I felt it was a good time to move on to other pursuits. And that's what I've been doing, more creative pursuits. I'm particularly interested in women's history, and I've been writing about that. And I also write poetry and creative essays. So it's a different part of me that I'm, that the right side of my brain, perhaps, that I'm starting to use a little more.
Right. And what was it like practicing medicine? Did you face discrimination based on your gender?
Well, it's interesting. When I started as a resident, you know, in medical training, when you finish medical school, you still don't know how to be what it is you're going to be, whether it's an internal medicine doctor, a pediatrician, or a surgeon. So you have to go through a training process. And for us in surgery, it was a 5-year training process. I remember at the beginning of that, one of my professors took me aside and looked down at me, of course, because I'm short and he was very tall. And of course, they were all men. And he said to me, Sylvia, because you're a woman, you have to work hard, really, to keep up with the men. And I looked up at him and I smiled and I said, that won't be hard. But I think what during my training, what mattered most is that I was willing to do the work and work as hard or even harder than the men. And perhaps I did actually do a little more because I knew of that disparity in how we were going to be looked at. I do know that when I finished my training with my credentials, I would have been asked to go into private practice by some of the surgeons, as they did for other male residents. But in my case, that was not done. But it didn't matter because actually I was asked to stay
at the medical
school.
And let me pause you there. You said that you had taken a more of a creative route after med school and practicing medicine for so long. But what made you interested in researching women's history in New Mexico specifically?
I've always been interested in history. Way back, I wrote an article, and I think in 1979, about women in surgery, which were few and far between. And then I've always thought about women's lives in general, and that interests me. And then when I came to New Mexico, I became interested in the lives of women here. Now, someone may say, well, but you're from New York, you're Puerto Rican, why New Mexico women? And my answer is that women are women, and women's lives everywhere around the world, and I've been many places, are in many ways similar. We're still not part of the mainstream, as it were, although we're always in the majority. So women's lives, to me, are the same, the basic elements of what they contend with day to day, how they go about doing the work they do, as well as taking care of their other tasks, the children, the household, the work. So I'm interested in women's lives, and women, New Mexico women's lives are just part of that stream for me.
Right. And getting to your research, Adelina Otero Warren was one of the leaders of New Mexico suffrage movement. Can you talk about her efforts and to include Hispanic women in the effort for ratification of the 19th Amendment?
Yes. So she actually started her actual suffrage work like in 1910 when her uncle, Solomon Luna, was a very powerful Republican in the legislature. And he encouraged her to work for the suffrage for the school boards for women. Women actually wanted to have regular suffrage. They were able to vote on every election, but that was not to be. So the women decided they would go after the suffrage in the school board elections. And so he encouraged her in that effort. And they did allow that in the Constitution. After that, actually, when the Congressional Union, which was the organization founded by Alice Paul, came into New Mexico, she joined the Congressional Union because they realized that without the Hispanic women, they were not going to get very far. At that time in New Mexico, 56% of the population of the women in the population were Hispanic. And so you really needed them, as well as the votes from the men in their families and in their communities, to pass the suffrage amendment in New Mexico. So they so she became engaged in that process, and so did one of her cousins, Aurora Lucero, who was the daughter of the then Secretary of State in New Mexico. She and Adelina wrote pamphlets in Spanish and were able to give speeches in Spanish to the population around the state. And that way, they were able to engage a significantly large part of the population that had been left out of the struggle for suffrage prior to that.
Mm-hmm. And how would you say the New Mexico fight for the vote impacted the national fight for suffrage?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you well there.
How did the New Mexico fight for the vote impact the national fight for suffrage?
Well, I think it did greatly. And as a matter of fact, Andrew Jones, Senator Jones, was then leader of the suffrage group in the Senate in the United States. And Adelina Otero Warren was very close to that effort, not only in the state, but also in Washington, D.C. And so she and Senator Andrew Jones coordinated while he pushed the Congress in D.C. She worked with the legislature here. So I think at the end, Senator Jones was very instrumental in getting the amendment through the Senate and then out to the state. So I think the struggle here impacted what happened nationally.
Right. And yesterday, the House passed legislation to remove the expired deadline for the Equal Rights Amendment. Can you explain what that means and what would this amendment do if ratified into the Constitution?
Well, the Equal Rights Amendment was written actually in 1923 by Alice Paul, because she understood that giving women the vote would not guarantee their general rights. So she said, women don't need their rights protected. They need their rights guaranteed. And that is what the Equal Rights Amendment would do in essence. Of course, there are always permutations of that guarantee, but the Equal Rights Amendment would grant women more protections under the laws of the United States. And so it passed the House in 1972 and went to the states for ratification. It needed to have 38 states to be able to go into the Constitution. However, at the end of that process in 1982, we only had 35 states. It took the rest of the time from 1982 till 2021 to get the other three states to ratify the amendment. However, the problem now is that the court has decided that it's too late. The amendment had a deadline for ratification, and that passed in 1982. So even these states, the three states that ratified it, can now go into the Constitution. So even though the last three states ratified it, it can't go into the Constitution. They say it's too late. I think that it isn't too late. It's never too late for women's rights to be recognized. And there are many efforts still being done. So one of them is in the House just Wednesday, I think. The amendment, the bill to end the deadline for ratification of the amendment was passed in the House of Representatives. That means that despite the fact that there was a deadline, we would ignore that and then just allow the last three states to come into the constitutional process of ratification. However, that bill to do away with the deadline for ratification now also is in the Senate, and they will have to vote on that. If both the House and the Senate vote that we will do away with that deadline for ratification, then I think that the amendment can go into the Constitution and become part of the law of the land, which will mean that women's rights will really have more guarantees, and we will have fewer issues with discrimination in terms of pay equity, in terms of accommodation for pregnant women in the workforce, in terms of the other issues that affect women in their lifespan that have to do with being unequal in society.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like we've been in the midst of a really long process, and we'll have to keep our eye on what happens there. But now I would like to introduce Barbara Jordan, an organizer with the Black New Mexico Movement in Rio Rancho and a retired Air Force veteran. Good morning, Barbara. Thanks for joining us.
Yes, good morning, Taylor. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, of course. And last year, you organized a rally in Rio Rancho with the aim to bring awareness around racial justice and getting people registered to vote. Tell me a bit about that rally. How did it go? And did you feel supported?
Oh, that rally, I didn't feel supported at all. It turned into a complete mess. But you know what? I am grateful because it really unveiled the hidden racism that was in Rio Rancho, and it let people know that Rio Rancho is not as picturesque as they would like it to seem, you know, like for it to appear. And so what that rally did was just, it could have been discouraging, but it actually encouraged me to continue to keep fighting for equality.
And you said you're from Rio Rancho, and this whole rally really shined a light on kind of what's going on there. And as the counter-protesters came in, what would you say you feel as a Black woman? Did you feel welcomed?
No, not at all. I felt completely threatened, and I felt unwanted here in Rio Rancho, and I still feel that way. And what was amazing to me is one of the protesters kept saying, go back home, go back to where you're from or whatever. And this is our city. And I told him, I said, well, I live in Rio Rancho. And there was a look of complete like shock on his face. And he actually got quiet and had to process what I was saying. I could see it on his face that he was processing it. And so, yeah, no, I didn't feel welcome at all. It really let me know the hidden racism that's here in Rio Rancho. And I'm fighting to change that.
Great. And we want to hear from you. What does Women's History Month mean to you? How are you learning about the many fights for equality? And how are you teaching others? Give us a call at 505-277-5866 or email us at letstalk@KUNM. And Barbara, I wanted to ask you, can you tell us a little bit about your experience as a social justice organizer and a woman at the same time?
Yes, it's harder for me as me being a woman and a social justice organizer because my counterparts tend to listen to my Black male activists more than me. And I often see this amongst white women, and I'm not sure why that is, but it's almost like the Black men are elevated, and then I have to fight to be seen. I have to fight to be heard. So it is difficult for me being a Black woman to be heard, but I know my voice is powerful. I know I have something to say, and I know I'm going to continue to fight for change, and I know it won't stop, so I just press on.
That's awesome. And can you explain this idea of allyship and how white women hold allyship?
Yes. So allyship is, you know, it's very thin line, I would say. Like, we need allies to come in and to stick it out for the long haul. We need for them to not come in and do it because it's a trend or, you know, for tokenism and things like that. We need allies who are ready to do the work within themselves and do the work that needs to be done for this movement.
Mm-hmm. And now the Black Lives Matter movement was founded by three Black women, Alicia Garza, Opal Tometi, and Patrice Cruellers, as well as the Me Too movement was founded by Tarana Burke, who is also a Black woman. How do you deal with the stigma around Black women's identity? And what has your experience been within the workplace in regards to harassment or just harassment in general?
Yes. So as far as like the Black women who started Black Lives Matter and, of course, the Me Too movement is often overlooked or we don't get the credit. You see the, in the media, you'll see they're trying to discredit Black Lives Matter movement or the Alyssa Milano has posted the Me Too hashtag, and the Me Too movement has started 2 years earlier. You know, so it's really hard for Black women to get recognized for the work that and the efforts that we do. And yeah, as far as like me in the workplace, I've experienced sexual harassment in the workplace. I've experienced racism in the workplace and every job I've had. So it's difficult.
Mm-hmm. And you are an Air Force veteran, correct?
Yes, 20 years.
Wow. And can you explain what that experience was like and how did it motivate your fight for social justice?
Yes, I want people to know when you're in the service, you experience everything as if you have a civilian job. So I experienced racism. I experienced sexual harassment in the military. You know, I didn't enjoy my time in the military, but while I was in the military, I fought for social justice issues and equality, and it just still fuels me to continue that fight after the military. So nothing changes, and that needs to actually change in the military. Like, we need our services to recognize that sexual harassment happens, that racism happens, and bring it to the forefront and stop, like, trying to blanket over it or hide the issue.
And it looks like we have a caller from Kate in Rio Rancho. Hi, Kate. Are you there?
Good morning.
Good morning. And what was your question?
Well, like Ms. Jordan, I am a resident of Rio Rancho. I've lived here for, I believe, almost 30 years. And I have had similar experiences in Rio Rancho as Ms. Jordan, although I assume not as intense or as horrendous. And I was hoping that perhaps we could communicate and perhaps form a new coalition and, you know, network and work on these issues in Rio Rancho, because as Ms. Jordan has identified, they are not good.
And what would you like to say to that, Barbara?
Yes, I would like to say thank you, Katie, for calling in, and thank you for acknowledging the racism here within Rio Rancho. It's always seems to be ignored. Like, if we ignore it, it's not happening, or Rio Rancho residents want minority residents to, quote unquote, stay in their place and not make any strife so that it could be a peaceful, quiet community. So, yes, we do need to make the noise. We do need to do the work. We do need to come together until there is change. And I've had several conversations, you know, with council members here, including Mayor Hall. And I understand that people are allowed to be racist. But when that racism is incorporated within our schools, within real estate, within the medical field, that's when it's a problem. And that's when we have, that's what we have to fight to end. You know, we need to expose it. The people need education. We need to end implicit bias, these type of things. So, yes, Katie, I'm down to work together so we can fight these issues together.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Katie, for your call. And it's time for a quick break. You're listening to Let's Talk New Mexico on 89.9 KUNM. I'm Taylor Velasquez, and we'll be back in a minute.
Hi, it's Mary Louise Kelly from NPR. Your holiday season might look pretty different this year. It's more important than ever to nurture our sense of community. Today is Giving Tuesday, a reminder to support organizations like this station, a nonprofit that helps your community stay informed and connected. You can ensure more news and more connection in your community by donating. Here's how, and thanks.
Make your Giving Tuesday donation at KUNM.org.
Tribes are among the leading entities cleaning up rivers, restoring wetlands, and using traditional methods to revive land compromised by pollution and mismanagement. We'll highlight some recent tribal ecological restoration projects on the next Native America Calling. We hope you'll make plans to join us.
Weekday mornings at 11 on KUNM.
And we're back. Welcome to Let's Talk New Mexico on KUNM. Have you ever been told you can't do something because you're a woman? How did you overcome that? There's still time to call in this morning at 277-5866. And now we're back with Barbara Jordan. And I would like to ask you, Barbara, what is the link between white supremacy and the violence against women?
The link between white supremacy and the violence against women is the need for the quote-unquote white males to feel superior. You know, it's the quote unquote, the need, because Black women are seen as the weakest link, right? We're the lowest of the lowest. We're the least respected. We have to fight for our voice, fight for her. So for white supremacists, it's easy for them to manipulate and to for them to rule and be rude and be racist and, you know, towards Black women. So that's the link between white supremacy and women. That's the link. They see us not even as human at times.
Right. And now I'm going to bring in our another guest, Atsa Dawn Chavez, Executive Director of the Native American Voters Alliance Education Project. Thanks for joining in this morning.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Great. And what have we learned already? What we've learned already this morning is that so many women of color have had their stories lost over time. That's also something we see as a result of colonization. Can you explain how colonization has impacted Indigenous women?
Sure, thank you. So I think one of the main things that we should understand is that Native women were highly influential in the broader women's movement, and that they were recognized throughout the country as Indigenous nations. They had autonomy and political power before the arrival of Europeans. And what we've seen is the influence of outside folks, whether it be the church or this overlying patriarchal attitude, but we've seen that really diminish the power of women as we are represented right now in the United States.
Right. And can you talk a little bit about what the suffrage movement looked like during the 20th century for Native women? And how did they continue after the 19th Amendment was ratified to fight for their communities?
I think the big thing here is that, you know, we need to look at the whole stories, the whole story. The barriers did not fall for all of us. Although the suffrage movement gave the right for women to vote, you know, it really was on the account of sex, and it didn't have anything in the code that said that we really needed to look at the other races. Although, you know, earlier in the 1920s, they were looking at just trying to get rights for Native women across the board. It wasn't until 1948 in the state of New Mexico that Native Americans were given the right to vote. And so it wasn't until the 1950s that you saw some of the women that were beginning to make use of that right to vote in the state of New Mexico. And I think one of the things that we need to think about when we think about the folks that we typically hear about in the suffrage movement is that they really grew up on the Haudenosaunee land, and they were inspired by that whole family and governmental structure. And so when you think about how they, people like Matilda Gage and Elizabeth Stanton, when you think about the context of how they were aware of and involved in these indigenous nations that they live next to, it really brings context and meaning to that famous Gage quote that we are not asking for a new right. We are asking for the restitution of a right that our foremothers had. And so, you know, during that time, we have a lot of Native women suffrages, including Marie Baldwin, who is Métis Turtle Mountain Bound of the Chippewa. We have Zit Kala Saw from Yankton Sioux, Laura Cornelius Kellogg, who was a NIDA. You know, and all of these women had more agency in society prior to colonization, but we really had to stand up and fight. In the state of New Mexico, there is a push to have more representation in government, especially by Native women. So Vernatella was one of the first women governors of the Pueblo of Isleta. We've had a number of women governors at the Pueblo of Powaki, like Thelma Talichi, Elizabeth Duran, Janelle Robal. And as we move into the future, we know that when we have Native women that are representing us, that we are a lot more successful just along the board.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned Powaki Pueblo, and right now they currently have all three leadership positions filled by women. Is this the first time that's happened?
This is the first time that that's happened for Powaki Pueblo, and in a large part for the Pueblos in general. The Pueblos in particular were influenced by the church. And so right now, there is still a lot of that patriarchal, stain that is overcasting the potential for a lot of Pueblo women to become leaders. And so as we see what goes on in Powaki, and as we know historically what happened with Isleta when Verna Teller was the governor, I think we can safely say that when women are in leadership, that we have a lot of really good positives that come out of that leadership.
Right. And what about women, Indigenous women who seek office at the state and federal level?
One of the things that we're seeing as the historic, election of Deborah Hallen and Cherise Davis in 2018 was the first barrier. That was the first time that Native American women was elected to Congress. You know, we had that maybe 25 years earlier with other women of color, but it wasn't until just 2-3 years ago that that happened for Native women. And now, as of Monday, we have the historic confirmation of Deborah Hallen as the first Native woman to hold a cabinet position. So what this means across the board is that more and more of our communities see that as a possible pathway, see that as a way to have adequate representation or true representation. And we know that it matters across the board. It's basically telling all of our youth that this is a possibility, that this is something that you can strive for. And we know that a lot of our youth, this urgency of the movement has really fired them up. There's so much at stake in terms of climate crisis, civil rights, state violence. Ms. Jordan was talking about, you know, racial justice as well. All of these things are starting to really inspire and invigorate our youth, you know, especially for the women. They're tired of seeing our mothers, sisters, and daughters be killed and go missing. And they're some of the strongest advocates for the missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls movement. And so we see this resurgence of folks that really want to do something about the state of their world.
Right. And it looks like we have a caller from Adele in Albuquerque. Good morning, Adele.
Morning.
And what would you like to add this morning?
Well, I wanted to say how much I appreciate that this show occurs. I was born and raised in Southern Louisiana, where women's rights just isn't a thing. And I'm so proud of New Mexico. And I'm so proud of, well, you guys, you know, for talking about these things and bringing up these comments. Like your guest said, when women are in power, we do better, you know? I mean, there's fewer conflicts, there's more representation, and I just wanted to say thank you.
Right. Well, thank you for calling in, Adele. And now I'm going to go to our final guest, Savannah Marr, a reporter with the Mountain West News Bureau here at KUNM. Good morning, Savannah. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
And talking about,
thanks for having me.
Yeah. And talking about women representing us in the federal government or state governments or leadership positions, you had interviewed many Native women about Deb Haaland and what she has been able to accomplish. What do you take away from these stories?
Yeah, it's been really a joy these last couple of months to talk to so many Native people about what this means to them to see her rise through the ranks of government, and particularly women and particularly young women. I spoke last month with two Northern Arapaho girls, Christy and Jasmine Wildcat. They're sisters. They are 17 and 22. And we actually watched the beginning of Deb Haaland's confirmation hearings together. And it was something that Jasmine, who was a senior in high school, she skipped school to watch that historic event unfold. It was just something that she couldn't miss. And yeah, I mean, it was very difficult for these two girls to watch her be sort of grilled by a lot of these older white male senators. One thing that that we talked about was that they really recognized the dynamics that were at play in that hearing from their own lives. Mm-hmm. Jasmine mentioned at one point, she said, this reminds me of the debates in my government class. She's a student at a majority white school in a very conservative town in the middle of Wyoming. And she recognized that, and she recognized the effort to sort of cast Deb Haaland as a radical from her own experience as well. So it was difficult for them to watch that, but they were also sort of watching and taking notes to see how did she push back against that? How did she sort of stand up? And I know that they were both really thrilled to see her sworn in this morning.
Right. And you mentioned that interview you did with the two young women, and they really talked about this stigma or the stereotype of the radical Indigenous woman. Is this something that you've heard before? And how do you think Deb Haaland takes this and is a leader?
Yeah, I think that it's something that a lot of Native women are familiar with, you know, having our ideas written off because of stereotypes like that one. But I think watching Deb sort of calmly respond to these questions, calmly repeat to these senators, you know, that actually she believes fossil fuels will be around in the United States for a long time to come. And it's something that we'll need to phase out slowly, and repeating that she is, a lot of the policies that they were mentioning, that they were challenging her on, were Joe Biden's climate agenda. I think watching her sort of calmly stand up to that and in the end be confirmed and sworn in, I think was really powerful for a lot of people.
Right. And one of the young women at the end of that interview we were speaking of earlier said that she now has hope that if she would want to run for president one day, she could. Why does representation matter? And how do we try to include that in your reporting?
Yeah, Christy Wildcat did. She has political aspirations, and she really looks up to Deb Haaland as an example of that. And I think it's important for people like Christy just to have, you know, a couple of years ago, I was working on the NPR show Here Now, and we interviewed Deb Haaland the morning after she was elected to Congress, the morning after she became one of the first Native women in Congress. And she said something in that interview that she didn't have anybody to go to for advice when she was running for that seat. There was no Native woman that she could call up and say, how did you do this? How did you handle that challenge? And she said in that interview that she hoped to be that person for the next generation of Native women wanting to go into leadership. And I think just seeing that somebody else has already done it and sort of that there is an existing path, I think that's really powerful. And with Deb Haaland, it's not, you know, just that she's a Native woman, although it is very powerful to see a Native woman rise to that level of government. She also is a person she's spoken openly about having experienced food insecurity, housing insecurity, raising her child as a single mother and dealing with the struggles of that. I believe she graduated from college in her 30s, law school in her 40s, and she didn't enter politics formally until she was in her 50s. There's a lot to look up to there if you're a regular person. I mean, when she was running for Congress, she spoke about how she was still paying off student loans. That's, you know, there's a lot for regular citizens of this country to see reflected in Deb Haaland that we don't normally see in people in the president's cabinet. So, yeah, it's been a big moment for a lot of people.
Right. And in your own personal experience, what made you want to become a journalist and report on Indigenous communities and make sure their stories are being heard?
Sure. So I come from a Native community in Massachusetts. I'm Mashpee Wampanoag. And my mom was a reporter when I was growing up. And I don't necessarily think that I like wanted to be a reporter when I was a kid, but I definitely thought she had a cool job. Like she was always She was always learning about new things and getting to like interview really interesting people and go places. She would bring me with her on reporting trips a lot of the time. And I just thought, you know, compared to a lot of the other grown-ups in my life, I guess her job seemed really dynamic and interesting. I don't know. I think it was when I was in college that I finally realized like, oh, I could do that. Cause I knew that I was a good writer. I knew what I wasn't good at. and it was just because my mom had, she gave me that idea and she gave me that example that was something that I could do with my life. And when she was a reporter in our hometown, she actually was sort of not really allowed to cover tribal issues. Because I think maybe we had like a distant relative on the council or something, and there was this idea that she wouldn't be able to cover the tribe objectively. So she was only able to do cultural stories and only very rarely. And I think our ideas around that in journalism have really changed a lot in the last, you know, in the 20 years between then and when I became a reporter. And now it's seen as more of a, you know, an asset and a form of expertise to be a cultural insider, reporting on something that you're familiar with. So that's a really important shift that we've seen.
Right. And you just moved here from Wyoming. Are you still seeing some of the same inequities when it comes to representation that you did in Wyoming?
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. And we're almost done.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I'm definitely seeing some of the same things, but with Deb getting sworn in this morning, I think that's a huge step in the right direction.
Right. That's great. Thank you, Savannah, for that. And that's all we have for today. Thanks for everyone who called in and to share your thoughts. And thanks so much to our guests, Kathleen Cahill, Dr. Ramos Cruz, Barbara Jordan, and Atza Don Chavez and Savannah Marr. Let's keep the conversation going and share your thoughts on Twitter using the hashtag Let's Talk New Mexico on Facebook and search for KUNM Radio or email letstalk@kunm.org. If you missed part of the show, stream it online or subscribe to our podcast. You can find it wherever you find your favorite podcast. Our engineer is Marino Spencer. Kaveh Mohed screened your calls and Ty Bannerman is our executive producer. I'm Taylor Velazquez. This is Let's Talk New Mexico on 89.9 KUNM.